This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear surgeon in New York City and New Jersey.
And I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a minimally invasive surgeon and a general surgeon in New York City. Those of you guys who know that we do this in the beginning for our intros, we try to mix it up, but she just totally mixed it up today. Made me laugh, did you see? Like, I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, and now today she's like, I'm an ear surgeon.
Well, but I do both ears, right and left, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Anyway, you guys, we have a great show lined up for you. We're going to be talking with Dr. Mark Shapiro. He's an internist who's also a hospitalist, and he is the host of Explore the Space podcast. And we're going to also talk to Dr. Christine Whalen. She is has her PhD in human ecology, and she's a professor at University of Wisconsin, and her students call her the Happy Professor. So we're going to be talking about health and happiness today.
We love that intersection, don't we, Marina, of medicine and happiness. And it's really why so many of us in healthcare do what we do. There is so much joy found, even in the hardest days as a healthcare professional. I hope we get that message to you. And, you know, these are tough times in so many ways around the world. And I think focusing on what we can do to find joy within our day is something really important.
It truly is. Well, as you guys all know, Sujan and I start off with a little bit of a discourse about the topics of the week. And of course, this past week has been extremely dramatic in a bad way for the U.S. anyway, in terms of that attack on our democracy this past week. And the hope and the silver lining is that our democracy is very strong. It's moving forward steadfastly and with resilience. So this is going to tie in very nicely because we're going to have Dr. Whalen on, and she can talk about that resilience and how we can also hold that within ourselves.
Yeah, I think there were so many emotions this week. COVID-19 is surging, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. There's that new strain, B117, which is easier spread, not necessarily inherently more deadly, but easier spread than the prior strains of COVID. We have passed, unfortunately, every prior statistic in terms of caseload in the United States. And we have a couple of graphics up to look at what's happening in the United States and around the world in terms of cases of COVID. In New York City, our positivity rate is much higher than it was when we were under siege in March. So we see this sort of, the next graphic will show us a sort of a two hump camel, right? So we see this March, April high positivity rate, and now we see our current high positivity rate, but there is some good news.
Yeah. Let's look at the next slide. And you know, the interesting thing about this was in April, March and April, when we started having our original first wave, we were learning how to take care of these patients. And what you're seeing here is that our death rate was significantly higher at that time versus you can see that the graph goes down very low. We're still seeing patients dying, but those days we were seeing thousands of patients die a day back in March and April of 2020. And now our death rate's in the anywhere from 140 to 180 a day, which is much less, obviously. And this graph, I think, really nicely depicts that. And a lot of that, again, has to do with a better understanding of how to treat it. Instead of throwing everything at the disease, you really try to minimize it and then use, you know, really streamline and personalize that care of the patient. Something we'll hear about from Dr. Shapiro as well.
Absolutely. And I just want to remind our viewers, Margaret Ambrosino says it's a great topic. It's a very appropriate topic for this week. And absolutely, we agree with that. Please share with your friends, like and tag your friends who might be interested in learning about what we're going to talk about for the next hour with our wonderful guests. As you know, we are live on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. And on Mondays, we are carried on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. You know, the other thing that's happened, Marina, is, as we've talked about, the vaccines were approved in December. And although the rollout was slower than we wanted, about 16 million vaccines have been administered in the United States and territories, which is really good. The incoming president-elect, Joe Biden, says there's going to be 100 million vaccines in 100 days. And
well, I think we have to talk about that, though, right? There's, as I think we talked about last week, the elephant in the room is that there are some healthcare workers that are saying they don't want to take it right now, right? So there's been some discussion about the ethics of holding doses, which was the previous administration's plan, was to, if you get 10 doses, then only inoculate 5 people because they need that second dose, versus the other strategy is give 10 people the dose because that way they'll have at least 80% immunity. One of the things that we should look
and at then that, and you order the dose for the second dose. It's not like those people
they can get it, and it depends though. Like and there's going to be one dose vaccines that come out, which we're all waiting for as well. But let's look at the slide of the U.S. that we have that shows how many of the states are actually kind of dispensing the vaccine of the doses that they have. So we have a graph of the United States, and it shows in different colors of what each state is doing. So the darker green, so Maine is doing 50% of their doses have already been dispensed of the vaccines, and then you can see where the color variations are within that. And so I think that that's interesting. In New York, we're at like between 30% and 40%. And you can see where the rest of the country is in terms of administering the doses. Now in California, you know, they're still like battling hard. I talked to my girlfriend last night, and actually this is a great segue. We can also talk to our other colleague who's in California who can really update us. So this is a good time to welcome Dr. Mark Shapiro. Again, he's an internist who works as a hospitalist in California. And also has the website, the podcast, Explore the Space. And we can talk to him about that a little later as well. And then Dr. Christine Whalen, who's a professor of human economy and whose students are call her the happy professor. And she's at the University of Wisconsin. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're so glad that both of you are here with us today. I think this is such a timely topic. I think, our audience really does appreciate when experts like you come in and tell us about what you do and better ways to live a healthy life. So maybe we can start with you, Mark. Can you just tell us what a hospitalist does and how you got to where you are in your medical profession?
Sure. Thanks for asking. So a hospitalist is somebody who specializes in the care of a hospitalized patient. To put it as simply as possible, we do our training just like everybody else, medical school and residency. Generally, people who go into hospital medicine do their training in either internal medicine in terms of their residency and board certification or family practice. And then you just enter that pathway and you practice in a hospital-based setting. It's actually the fastest growing specialty in the history of American medicine. It really started to launch towards the end of the last century, which is weird to say. In the first decade of the 21st century, though, is when it really started to grow. And it's in pretty much every major hospital system around the United States. And now what's happened is more and more specialties are taking on that same system of having a hospital-based physician to help take care of their patients. And for me, it was just the right stick. When I was a resident at UC San Diego, I was very inpatient heavy training. I found that I really liked that. I liked that kinetic atmosphere. I liked the dynamism. I really enjoyed the patients that I was getting to meet and walking through that hospitalization with them and learning together and communicating. So those sorts of things were great. I've been a hospitalist since I finished my residency in 2006. I've been doing it full-time ever since then, and I absolutely love it.
So this is just showing who can be a hospitalist, right? Like just a breakdown of the different specialties within medicine that practice in the space of the hospital, like as an employee of the hospital or working just at the hospital and not having a practice in a different location or like a clinic office.
That's right. And you know, the sort of example I would give is if one of you was to do a surgical case on a complicated patient, we would co-manage them together. You might let me know in advance or let my team know, hey, I'm doing this surgery and, you know, they're not going to go home that day. I'm anticipating 3 or 4 days in the hospital and there's some medical issues that I'd like some co-management on. That's a huge part of what we do. And one of the other things about it then that I love is that I get to work with people like you every day and we get to talk each morning. Hey, what's going on? What happened overnight? What do we think we should do today? Meet with the patient, talk with their family, connect with you again. That sort of dynamic, for me at least, is just it just feels like a really nice professional home.
So Bhargavi Ramamurthy says, appreciate our guests and appreciate all that we're talking about regarding healthcare. Thank you, Bhargavi. You know, one of the things that happens when we have complicated patients who have to stay in the hospital is that their primary care physician may not be able to round on them or see them in the hospital. So how do you manage the people who are on multiple medications, multiple care, in terms of coordination with their medical home, which is their physician in the community?
You know, that is one of the preeminent questions that we are still wrestling with in the world of hospital medicine. You know, we're a little more than 2 decades into it, and that is one of the barriers that we still have to recycle. As we're working with patients, right, we don't always have interoperability with our electronic medical records. So I might not be able to access the record from a facility outside the state of California or outside of my own medical system. So that can be a barrier. The crux of it, though, the cornerstone is just good communication, is, you know, picking up the phone, sending the text message, and making sure we access whatever we can in the moment. And then in parallel with that, too, the other key thing is working with and reassuring the patient that we're doing that. We don't want it to be happening in a vacuum, making sure that they understand, hey, I know that your primary care physician is Dr. X. I'm going to reach out with Dr. X, or hey, Dr. X and I are in the same medical group. We know each other. We have the same medical record. I'm able to access everything, and Dr. X is going to know all of the stuff that we're doing in the hospital. That sort of dynamic we found is very, very helpful. But one of the things that we have found over the course of time and studying as this new profession has evolved is that on balance, patients like having a hospital-based physician because we're so available. If their regular doctor is rounding on them, they might round in the morning, they might round in the evening, but during the day they're in the office. And now what we find is, for me, I'm there all day, so I can check in several times. I can communicate with them really easily, and that dynamic is good. But that's an ever-evolving friction point, and we're just continually striving to get better at it, for sure.
You know, one of the things that you said, it's a rise of a specialty within medicine in the past, you know, basically 20 years, right?
That's, yeah, yeah.
And it really, I don't know, was it really a big thing in the 90s? I feel like it really started, like, I want to say about maybe 15 years ago, only because that's when I started seeing people and they're like, well, it's a hospitalist. I'm like, who's that?
Yeah. You know, the first papers I think started coming out in the late 1990s, but you're right. You know, when I was a resident, 03 to 06, that's when we were just sort of starting to see it and the job market was open. So that when I was starting to look for jobs in, you know, late 2005, early 2006, at least in the state of California, there was a plethora of options in that space. But you're right. It's really been in that time period. It was just, we started seeing it, you know, 1998, 99, like when I was a medical student. And then since then, though, the rate of growth has just been explosive.
Right. So I want to ask a question actually for both of you and get Christine in on this conversation. So, you know, originally, when you look at hospitalists and who's joining and who's starting, now you have people coming out of practice and, I mean, coming out of training and doing it. But is it half of it that it's coming out of training because there's no other jobs that they wanted or couldn't, you know what I mean? Or that they're still trying to figure out if they're going to do a fellowship? Or is it people that have been in practice but then are coming in because of something called burnout, which is why, Christine, you're tagged on the other end of that. Mark, what do you say?
I think right now it's certainly still at admixture. I think people will enter hospital medicine because they come out of residency fresh, right? Their skill set is razor sharp. They can step right into it. And the job market certainly is a rich one, and you can do it anywhere in the United States. So if you want to move back home or go try somewhere different, you certainly can. I think in terms of who's doing it, it's definitely a mixture. We're seeing lots of people who are making a career of it. For me, that was the career choice that worked, and I've really enjoyed it. But there are some people who, as their career has moved on, it's a transition into it. But it's not a job that is, you know, an easier job or has a lighter tempo or anything like that. It's a fast paced, you know, demanding physically, mentally, emotionally position for sure.
We have just one slide. You said who's going into it. You know, this is She's On Call. So we have a slide looking at how, if women go into it more, because technically it's more of shift work. And there's, you know, as a surgeon, you know, Sujin and I don't, we work, you know, like we show up to work, we're working, you know, that this is part of that, you know, microaggression in medicine where women, it seems like people think that we don't work full time or things like that. But in terms of lifestyle and choosing, you know, a particular profession as well as considering being a hospitalist, this was just a slide that I pulled out looking at, are there more or less? And since you're involved with the society, just wondering what your thoughts were on that. And then Christine, would love for you to weigh in on the concept of changing a profession and trying to minimize burnout and improve your resilience.
There's no question that the profession of medicine, amongst the issues it needs to tackle as we move forward, is around gender equity. There's no way that we can not look right into that issue and step into that tension. It's absolutely critical that we do so. And that as we're shaping the jobs that we create and the expectations that we have for people, that it's done in a fashion that is equitable, that is sustainable, that is fair, and that feels right for the candidate. And that most importantly, we make sure we're still delivering the best possible care for our patients. The data around what happens when you set up those equitable frameworks, the care that patients receive is better. That's not debatable. So we have to work to get to that point. I think hospital medicine is showing how that template might work, but it's nowhere near done.
Yeah, you know, we have another statistic that Marina found looking at how male versus female hospitalists were paid. And for the same amount of work, women are paid a significant amount less as hospitalists. And this is covering the same patient load, working the same hours. So Christine, when we talk about burnout in healthcare and among physicians, one of the main drivers are these macro and microaggressions of being paid less, being valued less for the work that you do. You know, every time I am not recognized as a physician in the hospital, but as something else, that other profession is fantastic, but I'm not that profession. So I wonder if you can talk to us about finding our strength and our joy in the day when we are confronted by these sort of barriers to happiness.
Well, first, I want to say, Mark, it was so wonderful to hear about the hospitalist profession, because it's sort of like the hospitalist is the medical doctor, kind of equivalent to what I'm so passionate about, which is the study of human ecology. So human ecology is how individuals relate to their natural, built, and social environments. And so it's a very sort of holistic sense, like a hospitalist, right? It's this holistic sense of what we want out of life, how we thrive. And the focus is really on, instead of me, it's on we. And it's on that balance of me and we. So when you look at what makes us happy, it tends to be, you know, we tend to sort of think about happiness as something that you focus on internally, right? It's all about self-help and how can I as an individual make myself happy? But the research really clearly shows that it's pro-social behavior, that it is getting engaged in the community, that it's focusing on others that tends to bring us as individuals more happiness. And so what I love about the hospitalist profession really is that you're looking at the whole person, you are interacting with other specialties, and you're pulling it all together. And so often we get siloed. And I think that siloing leads to burnout, right? Because we feel that we're so dissociated with other people in other professions. And what I love about my job is that my students call me the happy professor. So like no pressure, right? If I'm having a bad day, I still have to smile. although I do often tell myself, you know, I tell my students the happy professor is not happy today. And I explain why. But the thing about having a more holistic and integrative approach to your field, whatever it is that you're constantly learning. You're constantly trying to learn from others, bring other specialties in, and you're really seeing the forest for the trees. I believe that helps people overcome burnout because you're doing something different and new every day. So anyway, I really love this hospitalist approach because it seems very much like my approach to happiness and well-being.
I think it's a great summary. I think you called it out really well. And that dynamism and kinetic nature of it is very exciting. You never know what's coming next. You really do have to have a high level of situational awareness and, kind of have your head on a swivel for lack of a better term. So yeah, it definitely fits that in it. Also, just like other professions in medicine, is struggling with the weight of physicians who are experiencing a manifestation or multiple manifestations of burnout. All of those same things, we are still at risk for it. So we're all looking for those solutions as well.
You know, there's burnout. There was burnout before this pandemic.
Right.
Right. We were looking at ER physicians who get burned out because it's so constant. You know, all the books that start out with, it was just another ordinary day. Well, we never have that, right? We in the hospital are never, ever having an ordinary day. It's always something different. Yeah. And so, but in terms of the burnout now, our burnout is much higher. It's been that way. And I don't know if it's the electronic health records and all the things that we have to do to document and do, at the hospital. But our burnout overall has just been increasing in physicians. But this year, this past year with the pandemic has been dreadful. One question to you, Mark, is what is going on by you in California? Because it's terrible in LA, one of my girls was telling me. And then after Christine, I want to talk to you about the measures that we're using to measure burnout. And I'm sure it's universal for everyone. It's that Maslach burnout inventory. But I want to get to that too. But first, Mark.
I think just a brief snapshot. Northern California is experiencing a different surge than Southern California, where I am just north of San Francisco. We have widespread community spread of the COVID-19 pathogen, but we don't have numbers right now, thankfully, anywhere close to Southern California. And Southern California and the central part of the state are really surging in quite a horrifying way. And I think that one of the main drivers of what's happening for healthcare workers in general, and this is one of them, there are many, is that sort of sense that they're not being seen. One of the barriers that we have is we don't show what happens in hospitals readily for obvious reasons, most specifically around patient privacy. But that gap leaves people feeling kind of unseen and unheard. And that is a particular challenge that I think has been unique to this, because in the past, when America has been faced with a crisis, part of that crisis management is a transparency around what the experience is like, to build public support, to build momentum around the right types of responses. And that's something that's not happening in the same way right now with the COVID-19 pandemic. And that is certainly a friction point.
So, we've had some questions come in from our viewers. One question was, if we're saying that the mortality rate has gone down in New York, what are we attributing these 4,000 cases of deaths too? And I think we saw a huge surge in the number of cases, which will therefore be a surge in the number of deaths after the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. We saw many super spreader events. And Nalini Kuke asks that, is it true that you can get COVID from gas pumps and supermarket carts? I don't believe that's true, but Mark, maybe you can answer that, and then we can talk to Christine, because you are, in fact, the lifestyle expert for Dear Pandemic. And I think talking about how you maintain a healthy lifestyle during this is very important. So, Mark, how do we get COVID, and why are the death rates so high right now?
the most common ways that we get it, we know, is through, you know, coming in contact with someone else's aerosolized secretions through the respiratory tract. So that's why masking is so important. Physical distancing is so important, and avoiding crowded indoor spaces is so important. In terms of surface acquisition, I think we found that it is likely to be less than we had thought, which is a good thing, but certainly good precautions around wiping down a surface before you're going to hold it like a shopping cart is a good idea. And then when you're doing that, avoiding touching your face, excellent hand washing. These sorts of things are critical, but the fundamentals are the fundamentals. Wearing your mask, avoiding crowded indoor spaces, avoiding close contact with anybody else. Those are the things that we know work. And in terms of what's happening, you know, we see curves of the disease and mortality in different cities. This is a big country, right? 335 million Americans. Yep. So I think we should count ourselves fortunate that despite all of the difficulties that we've had getting people to follow along with basic public health measures, with a disease that we know can do terrible things to the human body, we're just experiencing what we're going to experience. I think that to try to pin it down to one specific reason or to say, well, if it's not bad in New York, why is it bad in other places? The variables at play are extraordinarily complex. And I think we don't want to spend all of our time in that space here. This is a huge country. It's surging all over the place. It's not just surging in the big cities. It's surging in rural communities. It's surging in areas that don't necessarily have access to healthcare like we do in a major city, in a metropolitan center. So we're going to learn why down the road. But right now, it's just sticking with those fundamentals, sharing that message, and supporting your community to keep yourself safe, your family safe, and your community safe.
You know, it is, I really felt, and this is from talking to colleagues around the country, everyone really felt bad for us in March, April, May. And my colleagues were calling and saying, you know, what's going on in New York? But I also got the feeling from talking to them that they felt like this was a New York problem at that time because of our density of our population and the density of the different communities, depending on, you know, the socioeconomic status and also how, you know, people live together, you know, families and families. But that quickly changed, right? And I think to answer that question, as you said, it's spread everywhere across the country now. It is not a New York thing. It's a world thing. And that's why the death rates are higher all over. You're seeing higher numbers. But when we were at our peak and it was, quote unquote, just a New York thing, we got close to 1,000 if we didn't hit over 1,000 a day in terms of deaths.
And we should call out, right? The numbers are the numbers. It is an unspeakable tragedy. And we're going to be wrestling with the repercussions of this for generations. Numbers are numbers. It's really easy to, you know, silo off a number and say, well, thankfully it's not 4,500. The tragedy immersed in these daily numbers, I don't know how to compute it. I don't know how to tabulate it. And it's hard to even talk about it. It's absolutely shocking. It's anathema to what we do every day and why we went into this field. And I think, Christine, right, for you, I would only imagine, right, this is the opposite end of the spectrum of what the happy professor wants to be doing each day.
Well, yes, although, you know, it's really interesting when you have a pandemic that has lasted for all these months, people still have to get out of bed in the morning and live their day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
So we've seen a couple of things. First of all, we've seen a sort of an acceptance of these terribly high numbers and a sort of normalization of this, especially if it is not happening to you right now. And that's difficult, but also very psychologically normal. We have to continue to get out of bed each day and live our lives. And then recently, you know, we're right into the new year. So I had many people saying to me, all right, 2021 is going to be different. I have set all sorts of wonderful New Year's resolutions. And then my favorite Facebook meme was somebody who posted a thing that said, I'd like to cancel my subscription to 2021. I had my 7-day free trial and I don't like it. So I, you know, that is how a lot of us are feeling about 2021. We intellectually knew that there wasn't going to be a miracle cure when we hit the new year, but we still have to try to live our lives, and to do that means looking inward and engaging in self-care, thinking about what matters most to you, why it matters, how you can make it happen in your life, while also being open and sympathetic and supportive of other people who are in a different space than you are. So, you know, there are people who had a really awesome 2020. And I think this is actually really important to note. We, for obvious reasons, we focus on the on all the terrible things that happened in 2020. There are people that I know who have been very quiet about it, but they come and they whisper to me and they say, I don't know what to do, because when I didn't have to travel so much, I got to spend more time with my family, and my priorities and my purpose realigned. And I realized that I want to make some career changes, but I can't talk about this because so many other people are suffering.
Yeah.
So both of these things can be true at the same time, and acknowledging that one doesn't diminish the other, and the thinking about your individual experience while supporting others and being part of the collective, this is a very hard balance for people. And of course, that makes very interesting research for me, especially because what I try to do is take academic research and translate it into practical steps for people to use in their everyday lives. So I take all the research on how to be happier, how to live with purpose, and I try to break it into small steps programs. And I can talk about some of those if that's of interest. But so it is.
I would love you to talk about it. And we have Radhika Lakshman's question for you on underneath us. She is writing in from Kuwait, and people are really having physiological or physical manifestations of the anxieties that they are feeling. So how do they break it up bit by bit to get themselves to get over this and continue on with their day? And I have to tell you, before you answer Radhika's question, my family took a hike on January 2nd. It was a beautiful day here. And my son and I were talking, and we were like, you know, it was a terrible year, but in ways it was a really good year. We got to be with each other more. Marina and I started this show. He got a job after being furloughed for a long time. My second son graduated from college. You know, there was in fact a full year that passed with highs and lows. The lows were terrible, but some of the highs were really good. But so I appreciate you saying that, because I think it's important for us to acknowledge both the good and bad that happens to us. But I think this idea of how do you get past this choking feeling when things are so bad around you is really a meaningful one.
Right. So first of all, I don't think we get over it. We integrate it. Right. So we so all of these feelings are real. We have to understand that we are not alone when we have them. They are normal and they are real. Now, in the moment, of course, you know, especially if you are having a medical panic attack, then there are treatments for that. And you really should be talking to your doctor about that if this comes up more often. Then there are the more sort of the mild and the sort of mundane, but that really are impacting our lives. Like, for example, a bunch of the ladies on Dear Pandemic and I were chatting about how we're having nightmares about people not wearing masks. And we're at like, in our dreams, we are in crowds and we're noticing that people aren't wearing masks around us and we're getting anxious. So a lot of the anxiety of the day is also coming into into the night. So for many of us, me included, I can manage it pretty well during the day, but at night the demons come out on this. Now for others, when we're having these panics during the day, there are some practical things we can do. You've heard so many of these before, but first of all, turning off the news is okay. One of the things I talk with my students a lot about is there's privilege involved in saying, this doesn't apply to me. I don't have to deal with this. I'm going to turn it off. However, self-care is something that you got to engage in as well. So turning off the news and trying to separate yourself if you can is one important step. And then one of the things that I personally have learned is that all of these, the advice about mindfulness techniques and presence and centering techniques, you really can choose your own adventure when it comes to that and do what works for you. For me, it's important to get out first thing in the morning and take a walk. I walk to Starbucks. I don't actually get a Starbucks. My partner gets the Starbucks, but I do the walk every morning because it's important to get out there, get some exercise and sunlight. And that really seems to be an experience that calms me and grounds me for the rest of the day. So thinking about what works for you in acceptance and commitment therapy, it's called thinking about things like anchors, sails, and your rudder. So what are the anchors? What are the things that are keeping you safe in the storm? The sails, what are the opportunities, the wind in your sails, where you think you might go, and the good things. And the rudder is your purpose, is your direction. So where you want to be aiming yourself on this voyage of life. And thinking about those is a way to try to take control in the storm a little bit. And finally, research really does show us when we feel in control, we are happier. When we feel out of control, we are more anxious and more likely to have those panic symptoms.
I want to bring up we were talking about physician burnout before, but it's really people burnout, right? I want to bring up the Maslach score because I think that it brings up certain points that are important that people can ask themselves. It's like, you know, I wrote it out for the show and I was like, let me see, how would I answer this one? You know, so I want to put it up. So the question for you, Christine, is if you can just discuss the Maslach burnout inventory and how it can be used. It's usually used as a professional, but how, you know, someone can look at it and kind of get an idea of where they're at.
So with all of these inventories, especially if you are just a normal person using any of these inventories, I would see these as fairly sort of open-ended questions. A lot of people take these inventories and are going to judge themselves based on them. These are not Cosmo quizzes, so there is no sort of, you know, clear right answer. I went to the doctor at one point early on, well, I guess it was over the summer, and they gave me a modified a psychological inventory. And I looked down at this and I said, does everybody fail this right now? Said, yes, if you circle I'm totally fine, then I close the door and I talk to you about your dissociation and how you're doing. So right. So thinking about that locus of control, do you have say over your life? That's, I think, incredibly important. The thing that I also really like about this burnout inventory is the focus on values, right? So often we don't think about our core values. They are the background of our lives. And yet we tend to think about what we should value, what other people want us to value, rather than what we value ourselves. And so one of the things that I put together is this Mad Libs purpose statement, which kind of takes a lot of that burnout inventory, but turns it into a proactive way of thinking about what matters most to you, and then how to make it happen in your life. So there are five questions that I have in this inventory. The first question is, what are your three core values? Then I ask people, what are your three top strengths that you want to use in a day? So this is with the burnout inventory around the work. Like, these are the things that you want to do on a day-to-day basis at work or in your personal life. The third is, who do you want to positively impact? And these can be people or groups or causes or ideas, right? So who do you want to positively impact? Once you have those, what are the fears and anxieties? What are those top three fears and anxieties that get in the way of you doing this? And it's really important to understand that life does happen and that there are things that do hold us back. We have these fears. We're not going to outrun them. Instead, we want to incorporate them. And then finally, what are three purpose-based commitments that I can make either today or this year to kind of live that out? And then I put it together in this Mad Libs purpose statement. You can find it on my website. Here's the way the sentence goes: because I value, and then you insert the values. I will use my gifts for, you insert the gifts, to positively impact the lives of. And then you say, understanding that I have these fears and anxieties about, I will still today make purpose-based commitments to do the things that you want to do. And this is a way of taking those kind of core ideas of the burnout inventory and putting it into a proactive thing that you can do with yourself, either on a daily, weekly basis, or as a better alternative to a New Year's resolution.
Yeah, no pressure, Christine, on daily. My God, I was listening to that. I was like, okay, top three, every day, this is going to be a problem.
But I love it. I think that this is a way to take something that feels out of control and out of your control and make it something that you can control. And I just wrote it down again, so I'm going to say it again for our audience and for me. The three core values that you have, your three top strengths, who do you want to positively impact, your three top fears and anxieties, and the three purpose-based commitments that you want to make. And, you know, Marina and I were talking about this, and part of our part of our angst is this lack of a proper vaccine rollout, you know, lack of masks, lack of hand washing, et cetera. And, you know, she and I were saying, you know, it's time for us to volunteer and give injections. It's time for us to do not just this show, not just talk to each of our patients, each of our hospital employees that we come into contact with every day, because we are doing that as a one-on-one, but maybe volunteer to give vaccines. And I think having this sort of purpose-driven approach, as you've outlined, it's really energizing. You know, we both teach residents, and this is certainly something I'm going to talk to my residents about, because they've been affected. You know, you, Mark, as a hospitalist, you know what the scene has been inside the hospitals, and the trainees have been pulled away from what they're supposed to be learning in order to take care of something that really does feel out of control.
I mean, and that's the thing, right? And Mark, you can certainly speak to that, that medical education and deployment of resources has been at crossroads. Loggerheads, right? While all the residents are learning, but when they're pulled off their desired trajectory or specialty to do other things, they understand their value to the health system, but their education is also being delayed, I think.
You know, Marina, I think that that's actually a critical point. I think that we can extrapolate that to the majority of people that work in healthcare in any capacity, that they feel like at some point of the day or over the course of these weeks and months that they are being asked to do things that they may not necessarily want to do, they may not have been trained to do, they might feel like are unsafe, they may feel like the mechanism by which they're doing them does not feel properly supported, or that the messaging around it is inconsistent. I think we've seen a lot of all of those things. And I think that in experiencing that, that is one of the drivers of that sense of disconnect of what is my purpose? What are my values? This is why I'm doing this work. And now I'm in this completely different space. And I certainly hope that that can get better. And, you know, Christina, I love that statement. I mean, you had me at Mad Libs, if I'm being totally honest. I think that's a brilliant way to present it, that. And I think you also called it a choose your own adventure. And I just wanted to rip up an applause. Those are the best things ever. But when we do these personal exercises, I think it's also good that we acknowledge that in doing it, it's hard. As I was reading it and hearing you, I was thinking to myself, personally, how would I do this? And I had that tightness, that, oh gosh, just that moment of inertia of how would I hold myself personally accountable to doing this? I think it's also critically important, though, that while we can take ownership of certain things, we need to expand and solidify our expectations of those who have the ability to do this at an organizational level, at a division level, at a state and national level, to pull those same levers to ensure that this is done in a scalable fashion. Because circling back to where we were at the beginning of the show around how people are struggling with what they're experiencing, me doing this personal inventory is going to have a nice ripple effect, right? I'm tossing a pretty sizable stone into the lake of my community and my family. But for us to do this, to access 335 million Americans, and then to do it at a really, it's a worldwide pandemic, to do it at that higher level, we do want to expect and integrate that higher level of accountability as well.
Yeah. And the thing about it is for all of us, and I'm totally there with you about this idea of a tightness in your chest when you think about actually following through on any of this. Which is why I also created a kind of daily version of this. And while it actually makes it kind of easier to do it on a day-to-day basis, because your purpose-based commitments can be, like, for example, making a baked potato bar for my family can be one of my purpose-based commitments, right? Because doing that baked potato bar with my kids, that is in keeping with my values of family and creativity. Right. And so thinking about it in terms of the smaller concrete things that you do that you might do anyway, but giving yourself credit for it, giving yourself a pat on the back for continuing to act in small ways in keeping with your values. I find that very grounding. You can do it as a family. You can do it as a work team. You could do it with your residents. These are all ways of kind of keeping ourselves on track. Don't make it so big that you know, it's not going to happen. But keeping yourself on track and grounded, and again, giving yourself credit for the wonderful things that you are doing every day, because so often that's really the problem. We are acting in keeping with our values and our purpose. We're just not taking the time to recognize it and feeling good about all the good stuff we do.
We have so many things to talk to you guys about, but we do want to delve a little bit into some of the other things that you guys do, right? So do you want to ask them or, you know?
Yeah. So, well, one is I want to say AJ Nathan, who is a medical student, writes, as a trainee, I hope our experiences with COVID continue to move the culture of medicine forward on valuing wellness and health as opposed to taking care of illness. And I think that's really, you know, you think about all the positives that may have come out of this terrible time. I think that's one of the things that's actually very important. Mark, you have a podcast called Explore the Space. And I wonder if you can talk to us about what that means and what you do with that podcast.
Yeah, so Explore the Space started about 5 years ago, and the concept around it, right, I was a mid-career physician at that time, and I was doing some leadership work and kind of had my feet in the world of healthcare, but also want to acknowledge that everyone's experience of healthcare is different, and what I was interested in doing was looking at how healthcare and society interface, where those gaps are in terms of understanding and logic and empathy, and then bringing those things together in a conversational manner. Because at the same time, I was an early podcast adopter. I loved listening to them. And so it felt like an interesting place to sort of start. And by design, I have a very, very eclectic mixture of guests, and we cover a wide variety of topics, things around leadership, gender equity, climate change, gun violence, COVID-19, all sorts of different things around that. We've, you know, over the course of 2020, right, we can be very topical and very agile. So we have content around anti-racism. We have content around the expanding pandemic. We did a lot of work around the 2020 general election, the presidential election. And in doing that, what I've found, right, that same sort of kinetic nature of being a hospitalist that I love, that same dynamic takes place on Explore the Space podcast, where these extraordinary guests, people from all different backgrounds and training with these levels of expertise that just make your eyes dilate. It's just the most extraordinary thing to see. When we can access that and start to learn from it, we can really start to leverage change because we have that better sense of shared understanding. What is it like to try to do something in the world of climate change from outside of healthcare, recognizing that it's a public health crisis? I like to refer to it as our apex predator. How do we access that when the medical profession doesn't seem to have its hands over it yet in terms of how do we educate around it and learn about it? How do we have these conversations around gender equity in healthcare where, like that slide you showed, right, there are huge issues, and COVID has actually put a lot of those issues into specific relief and even exacerbated many of them around gender equity and around inequities in healthcare and structural determinants of health. These are large issues, and it's a good exercise for me, right, purpose-driven stuff, to step into that tension and acknowledge, look, for me as a white male physician, these might be challenging to talk about, but it's a great opportunity to learn and to build a sense of community, to build an archive that is evergreen where people can come and access and pull out these great things and learn from it. So with the idea being, how do we move forward and how do we get better?
Thank you. Thank you for that. One thing, one of my colleagues in New York wrote that, you know, it is a complicated question. I'm just going to put up, it's Tony Bine is one of my colleagues. And he points out that, you know, currently with asymptomatic patients are the ones that are putting, you know, are 30% transmitting the disease. And also we now have 30% in New York of our healthcare workers are not accepting the vaccine. And so I don't know that there's an answer to his question. And what are we going to do about it? I think it's still just somebody has to be the guinea pig. I've always said to everybody, I'll be your huckleberry. I'm going in there. Yeah. I'll get it. So yeah. I did it. 85% of the physicians at our hospital systems have taken the vaccine. And I think that this is one of those times and opportunities for those of us who believe in the science and really grasp it, understand it, to show that we're willing to stand and take the vaccine. It's very much like, I'm blanking on the guy who, I think it's the Brooklyn Bridge, right? He built the bridge, it has the give, and he stood under it with his family to show them that it was, I hope it's the Brooklyn Bridge, and I'm not messing this up, but I'm pretty sure, but he stood under it to try and show that it was, it was an okay.
Yeah. So I'm actually getting my second Pfizer vaccination tomorrow. And so going to experience that however I experience it, but it's a great call out. And we are learning that there is a wide variety of people having hesitation around the vaccine. One of the episodes of Explore the Space that we did recently was with a friend of mine, Dr. Jasmine Marcellin, who's an infectious disease specialist at the University of Nebraska. And she talked about this in a way that really, it just knocked me sideways. She and I had actually, as it turned out, had both gotten our first vaccination that morning. And the episode's in the archive of Explore the Space. If you want to check it out, it's on the website at www.explorethespaceshow.com. But the way she lays out how to talk about, how to access priorities, how to understand where the hesitancies come from and leave it open for further conversation, I really thought it was extraordinary. And that is the work that we're going to have to do. That is the skill set that as healthcare workers, we're going to have to develop. And that also we're going to have to widen the pool and deepen the pool of people who can do it. Because to vaccinate, right, 80% of 335 million Americans, it can't just be hospitalists, surgeons. It can't just be us. We need an armada, an army of people to do this at scale to get it done quickly. Everyone needs to start to develop that faculty, that skill set, that toolbox to work through those conversations with their family, with their friends. And if they're in a clinic where they can administer vaccines, it's a big ask. But the way that it was laid out there, right, those tools exist. And we can't be passive. We have to be active, because as we do this work, as we get better at it, that's what unlocks the whole pandemic for us.
Yeah, I think all of us are doing one-on-one, trying to meet the person where they are. Yep. You know, there's no point in making fun of somebody. Oh, ho, you don't want to take the vaccine. That doesn't generate anything. But saying, well, why don't you? And what questions can I answer for you, you know, from having looked at the history of healthcare in the United States, which, you know, could be another whole show in and of itself, and kind of getting there. And I think you're right. I think we do need sort of a huge army of people of varying experiences to help our country and our world move forward. So, Christine, can you tell us a bit about the big picture?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. But I want to say that I think this is a really important topic because it also relates back to some of the things that I do. Whenever we try to get somebody to do something, people are much more likely to do things that they want to do. Now, I know that sounds like a very basic thing to say, except that often in our lives, we're trying to convince ourselves to do things we have to do or we should do. But we're much more likely to do things that we want to do. And to make somebody want to do something means calling on a higher purpose, calling people to be part of something bigger than themselves. And we've seen this historically with all sorts of various different mobilization efforts, whether it's war mobilization efforts or whether it's previous vaccine efforts. So my hope is that there aren't just doctors thinking about this, but there are folks who are historians, who are psychologists, who are marketing folks, who are coming together to have a discussion about how to make people want to be a part of this vaccine, this treatment, this prevention treatment, and the next phase forward. So around that, those ideas, you know, this is sort of what I'm interested in, is that idea of purpose. And I wrote a book called The Big Picture, A Guide to Finding Your Purpose in Life. And it is actually geared toward young adults or people starting out in their careers. And the reason why I chose that audience is because there are already books out there on purpose and meaning formation for people in their 50s, 60s, and beyond, because we had this old-fashioned idea that purpose was something that you thought about at the end of your career rather than at the beginning. And I thought, well, gosh, I'm working with these kids in their 20s, and they should really think about having some purpose and a rudder for their journey right now. So I translated with my students, with thousands of my students, the advice from books geared toward folks in their later career and even into their retirement, and took that for folks in their earlier part of their career. And it's been a really wonderful opportunity to take those big ideas of purpose, demystify them, and give us some small steps approaches to using them in our everyday lives. And in fact, there is no link out yet, but I'm just going to give you a little teaser, because I think the link maybe comes out tomorrow. I have done a sort of mid-career translation of this book as a great courses series on Audible that that is going to come out in the next couple weeks. And I should have a link fairly soon. But if you're interested in this, check the Audible space under my name. There's going to be a Finding Your Purpose series that is going to try to translate this, the academics of purpose, for folks in mid-career. So then we have the whole spectrum covered.
But I want to say one thing, though. You did this for young adults, but I'd say having two kids in college right now, and Suja, you probably can speak to this or have the same experience, that my kids are very thoughtful about the world and what's going on. And I credit their schools and that sense of community that they built within their schools, and also bringing up these topics, these controversial topics, where they feel like they do want to make a difference. Not that they're trying to save the world, but they do feel that this is part of what they want to do. So I love that you have the book, but I feel like some of your students are probably already geared that way, even when they come in freshman year.
So interestingly enough, 10 years ago, that was not the case at all. In the last couple years, we are seeing more of a shift with more people being conversant in this idea of what matters most to me. Now, when we think of purpose, it's not really just about where you're going to volunteer, right? I think that's what people think about a lot. And the young generation right now, they've done wonderful volunteer work. But really, this is a matter of who you are and what values matter to you, not what should matter to you, what your parents want to matter to you. And so what I'm finding is that my students say, nobody has ever asked me and given me the time and the space to think about these topics on my own and to be able to reject, you know, what other people may want me to do and to think about what matters to me. And so that's what I try to do with my classes. I try to ask the questions. I don't give them answers. I ask the questions and give them the space to think about this. And then I've been doing these time capsule exercises where I send their purpose statements back to them a year, 2 years, 3 years down the line. And they're able to see whether they are headed in the direction that they were hoping to be headed in when they graduated.
You know, I think that is really wonderful. And I agree. I think, you know, youngsters these days are just so much more more mature than we ever were, and more forward thinking, more holistic, I think, than we ever were. I don't know Jody Greger, but she is one of our viewers, and she is now, I am now her number one fan. She is an OR nurse waiting for her second dose of the vaccine. And because elective surgeries have been canceled, she's being deployed to a floor, and she hasn't done floor nursing in 30 years. And yet, like all of us deployed elsewhere, she is hoisting herself up, nervous, but feeling like she's going to contribute and she's going to make the world a better place. And maybe, Mark, you can give her some advice about what to expect leaving the OR for 30 years and coming back to the floor.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is thank you to Jody for giving us the advice and setting the example and being vulnerable and sharing what we're all experiencing. Saying that you're feeling unprepared, you are not alone. We all feel like that. We are all figuring this out on the fly. We're all being asked to leverage skills that we don't necessarily have. What you're doing sounds really difficult, and you're not alone in that space. And sharing that with us validates it for all of us. So I appreciate you putting that out there, quite honestly. I think in terms of the granular day-to-day work, hour-by-hour work, it's the fundamentals, right? Safety's got to be the priority. Take your time. Ask for help. And just move through the day knowing that you have that skill set there. But I just really appreciate you in this sort of a forum coming out and sharing your experience, because what you're doing is it's incredible. You're going to remember it forever. I'm going to remember this specific moment on this show because of what you just shared. And this is the sort of thing that helps us change the whole tapestry, change the momentum behind this. And so I'm grateful to you, and I'm glad that we get to have this sort of discussion. But just, you know, just walk carefully through the road. It's a difficult one, and we're all kind of figuring it out together. So lean on the people next to you.
And also, you know, your training is your training. I mean, that there's a reason you went through all the training that you did, and it's there and it comes to the fore when you need it.
Yep. So I want to thank our guests. This has been an incredible hour. I'm feeling more positive today and at this time than I have in quite some time. And I want to thank both of you for that. We're having some great comments coming in from Nick Chin, from Jayashree Sundaram, about what a terrific show this was. So thank you very much, Dr. Mark Shapiro, Dr. Christine Whelan, for spending your time and imbuing us with your positivity.
And we're going to check out dearpandemic.org also. We didn't really get a chance to really explore that, so we will. But you guys can also do it offline on FaceTube.
There you go.
Okay, with that, I'm going to have to credit our producers. Thank you so much, all of you guys, for watching. Thank you for joining us, both Christine and Mark. And again, thank you to our producers. And stay tuned for next week. We're going to be talking about medical school and activism with our guests, who are Lash Nolan and Alec Kalick, who are both medical students and doing great things during this pandemic and also continuing their medical school education.
Thank you guys so much.